reached out, I got excited because I said, I don't really have anybody from Moldova. And I was watching one of your videos, and it's interesting what you said. You were talking in front of the audience, and you said...
About my accent.
About your accent and about Moldova. You actually mentioned that it was rated the country as a country number one, which is the most pessimistic or something.
Yes, one of the least happy countries in the world. Yes, that's right. That's right.
Where is this coming from?
It was a United Nations report which evaluated happiness in countries, and Moldova was rated one of the least happy countries in the world, much less happy than the countries around it. One of the, I don't know why. I was 10 when I left, so I have no idea why, but that made me especially glad that my parents left and that they chose not to stay in Moldova.
Interesting. Have you ever come back to Moldova to visit?
Just traveled to visit some relatives, maybe about 10 years ago or so.
And what was your impression?
It's hard to have an impression. It was definitely quite a bit less well off than I recalled when I was a kid. And I mean, I traveled to Moscow on that same visit, so it was Chisinau, the capital of Moldova, was much less well off than Moscow. It's hard for me to say, but there's clearly reasons that it's one of the least happy countries in the world, and I don't really know why, but there's certainly reasons, and it makes me especially glad that I'm not living there anymore.
All right, interesting. Well, I'm happy you are happy in this country, and if you reflect back on your story of immigration, what do you remember, how it started? You came to the United States.
Yeah.
And what are your memories of coming here?
So... yeah, I came. I recall that it was really hard for me to get used to the culture here. It was a big break for me. I was 10 when I came. And coming from a place where I knew how to do things and knew the rules of the game, so to speak, coming to a place where I don't know how people are supposed to behave, I don't know what the cultural background is, you know, all the little things that tell me how to behave in appropriate ways. That was very traumatic and very difficult as a kid to have that transition. And so it was difficult to not have any friends. It was difficult to not know, you know, any, you know, the little kid games that you play. So that was definitely a break, and it made me an outcast and marginalized among the kids.
Interesting. And what about the language?
The language was part of it. So I studied it a little bit when I was going to, my parents chose to take me to, what is it called? An English language, a school that had a secondary language, English. So I had a little bit of English, but of course that was a huge break, and that was another thing that made me more an outcast. So I was much further ahead in math than I was in English, so it was kind of like a combination of skills. You know, my math was quite a bit farther ahead than the other fifth graders who I was with, and my English was very bad.
You were behind with English.
Yes.
Did you feel any worse because of that? Because you couldn't communicate to your pals at school at the level that you probably wanted to? Did you feel you were abandoned a little bit?
Abandoned. I felt that my parents couldn't help me because they couldn't really have they didn't have the skills to help me. I mean, they didn't have English skills, and they didn't know the sort of the rules of the game, how to get ahead and advance yourself in the society, unfortunately. So they didn't know that, and they didn't know what they're supposed to do. They just knew, hey, here's a school, kind of take me there. And yeah, not knowing the rules of the game, not knowing how to behave, the social norms was very difficult.
I can imagine. And how did you personally and your family guide yourself in this society? You obviously had to learn how to function in this country. How did you do it?
Well, what I learned is that I was always someone who was interested in how and why people thought and how and why they made their decisions. And that actually coming here as an immigrant was in some ways helpful because I was not so, it's kind of like when you're a fish in the water, you don't notice the ocean around you. But when you come here and you observe, oh, this is why people do this and this is how people do that, you learn how to have an outside perspective on your own, on the context that you're in. So that's what led me to my eventually do what I'm doing right now, which is teaching people how to make better and more effective decisions, because the intuitive way that we make our decisions is pretty bad, according to the research on this topic. So having that background as an immigrant was quite helpful in causing me to go in this direction because it helped me observe how and why people did what they did.
And when you were observing people being a little boy, do you remember what kind of thoughts you had? Because when you observe, you constantly analyze.
Sure.
I guess the question is, how did you decide for yourself, being a little boy, okay, I think I want to adopt this habit or thought, and I absolutely don't want this? How that process happened in your head, or if you remember?
It's hard for me to remember, honestly. What I remember wanting was to. I was always someone who was an analytical person and observed things around me. And I knew that I wanted to go into a direction that is analytical and fulfilling for me. And so that's how I eventually end up going to where I'm going. But I don't recall. I mean, as a kid, I always was interested in reading books, things like this, and I knew I wanted to do something that's tied with analysis, thinking, reading. And of course, far from everyone does that. My parents were not, in many ways, they weren't helpful in this direction because they were very much, as many immigrants are, financially oriented, and that's not something that I was as concerned about as they were. So that
Interesting.
was a difference between us.
Interesting. And did it bother you in some way that your parents, they were thinking how to provide a good living for the family, and you were more of an that analytical person, boy that looked different direction? Did you have any contradiction with that as a family?
Well, it was just a different value set, and I knew that that's not something I wanted to pursue, their value set. They would have liked me to pursue a more financially lucrative career, becoming a doctor or something like that. But that was a point of tension between us because that's not something I was so interested in. And I obviously decided not to go into that career, and I'm very pleased that I didn't.
So you have no regrets that you chose this career and you're helping people with the decision making.
No, I have no regrets. I mean, that's what led me to write my book, Never Go With Your Gut, How Pioneering Leaders Make the Best Decisions to Avoid Business Disasters, which is a best-selling book by now and quite popular, helping people, professionals of all sorts, whether from business owners to other sorts of professionals, whether doctors, lawyers, and anything, make better decisions in their careers and their businesses. That is very fulfilling for me because I can see how they would have suffered a lot if they didn't have the benefit of my expertise. And from what I remember myself, morally, it was really important for me, always really important for me to prevent suffering for people. I mean, I'm a person who is at heart utilitarian, meaning wanting the most good for the most number. And so I'm really fulfilled by helping people avoid suffering.
And when did it start? When did you realize that? When did you have this thought? Okay, I think people don't make right decisions because they're following their gut, and I want to help people with their decision making. Do you remember if it was?
Yeah, I remember it when I saw my parents fighting over various stupid issues. I mean, my mom wanted to buy a $50 sweater, and my dad saying, no, sweaters should never cost more than $20 or something like that. And there were so many of these fights and conflicts, and I saw that they were making really bad decisions in their relationship with each other, especially over financial issues. So seeing that was one thing that impelled me as a kid to be interested in why do people make bad decisions? Like my parents make a lot of bad decisions, and how can I help people make better ones? Because I didn't want other people to suffer like my parents. And then, so that was one. I was born in 81. I came to the United States in 91. And as I was coming of age, when I was 18, it was 1999. So in the United States, there was this big tech bubble, the dot-com boom and bust. So I saw a lot of people who were supposedly very smart, tech leaders and investors, lose a great deal of money in the dot-com boom and bust around that time. And that showed me that people who are, I mean, and then you had various business leaders of Enron, WorldCom, and Tyco used fraudulent accounting to try to hide their losses. And that was very sad for me, because I mean, they made terrible decisions. I mean, in a couple of years, they went to jail, did the perp walk. And so they clearly made really bad decisions. And these investors, financial leaders, tech leaders made really bad decisions. And of course, a lot of ordinary people lost their life savings investing into these companies or Enron and so on. So seeing that made me realize that it's not only my parents, it's all, these very prominent top people around me who made terrible decisions. So that's how I got into decision making, into the science of how do we make good decisions and how do we avoid bad ones.
So this global picture basically expanded your vision, and you decided to go to the next level. And when you decided to go to the next level, was it the time when you were in college? When exactly in your lifetime it happened?
It was in my last year in college when I was deciding whether my parents wanted me to go to become a doctor, as I mentioned. So I was thinking throughout college, okay, I'll, probably be a doctor. But in the last year in college, that's when I really thought about how do I want to live the rest of my life, and that I didn't, being a doctor wouldn't be fulfilling for me. Whereas looking and studying how people made their decisions and contemporary historical business contexts was much more fulfilling for me. And so that's when I made this decision, made this switch. And so that's when I headed off, like I said, around the turn of the century, when I was in college at that time. So that's when I really decided, okay, this is what I want to study, and this is what I want to help. And this is how I became a coach and consultant and trainer and speaker on decision making. Of course, I also went into higher academia, so I'm a cognitive neuroscientist and behavioral economist who studies and researches the stuff, published a bunch of peer-reviewed papers on how do we make good decisions and avoid bad ones, as well as consulting, coaching, and training on this topic.
Excellent. Is it the time when you were in conflict with your parents because you?
Yes, I was in conflict with my parents because they wanted me to become a doctor and they didn't think that this career of helping people make better decisions would be financially lucrative. And this is kind of a difference in values where I cared more about preventing suffering for others than about how financially lucrative my career would be.
Interesting, interesting. So you put people before your financial well-being, is this correct?
Yes, this is
Thank
correct.
you.
This is yes. So, and it's a different choice than my parents had made themselves. So it's a different value set. And
Interesting, interesting. So coming back to your books, what was the first book that you published?
the first book was an academic book, and it was just exploring kind of dense, high-level academic book. That's the result of my dissertation. So I wrote a dissertation in my graduate program, and then I eventually published that as a book. So it's not something I recommend people read because it's very dense and it's written for other academics. The first book that I wrote for a broad audience is called The Truth Seeker's Handbook, a science-based guide. And that talked about how and why we fail to see the truth of reality because of how our brains are wired, so that we see what we like to see, we see the world through rose-colored glasses rather than seeing the truth of reality and how we can change that. So that was my first book published. That was my second book for a broad audience. That was published in 2017. My first book for a broad audience was called Find Your Purpose Using Science. And talked about finding a sense of meaning and purpose using science-based strategies. And that was some of the high-level decision-making that we can do to develop a sense of meaning and purpose. So that was the first book. And the second book was How Do We See the Truth of Reality? Because if you don't have accurate information, you can't make good decisions. And then the next book that I wrote, the one that I'm currently talking about and sharing with people about, is Never Go With Your Gut, How Pioneering Leaders Make the Best Decisions and Avoid Business Disasters.
That's so interesting. When we get connected and I read some of your credentials and I started to do my small investigation on your background because I got interested in what you're doing, and I saw the name of the book. Mm-hmm. And I raised my eyebrow and I said, this is not what everybody says. Let me read what he has to say in his book. And I started to read your book, and I was in a constant contradiction because the way my brain is wired, follow your gut. And I test this all the time, even with small decision making as I go through my day. And as I was reading your book, I saw that you explain it from the scientific point of view, which I absolutely love, for the same reason I follow some people on social media. And I see it makes a lot of sense when you say never follow your gut. And you talk in the beginning of your book about intentional decision making and autopilot decision making. Mm-hmm. So yes. Can we elaborate a little bit more on this?
So the autopilot, recent research has shown that the previous framework of how our mind works, the Freudian id, which is kind of the emotional self, the superego, the really rational self, and the combination, the ego, is not correct. It's not how our brain actually works. How our brain works is more having two systems of thinking that they actually communicate and interact with each other. There's the older system, which is the autopilot system. And that is the emotional, instantaneous, very quick system. It's the system that feels very comfortable. It's the go with your gut system. And that is one system of thinking. And that's the older one. And it's much more powerful. Then there's the more rational system of thinking, the intentional system. That's the one that deals with abstraction, social interaction, complex concepts, learning new topics. That has been much more recent system, and it's much weaker. You know, when you feel yourself trying to prevent yourself from eating that third chocolate chip cookie, that's when you're using your intentional system to restrain your autopilot system. And the autopilot system has been evolved for the savanna environment, when we were hunters and foragers living in small tribes. So it's very tribal. We want, and what does tribalism mean? Well, it means that we like people who look like us, who think like us, who have our value sets, who came from the same countries we do, who have the same accents and so on. And we don't like people who don't. That's the natural intuitive thing. We're naturally tribal. That's the human condition. So that's one aspect of the autopilot system. Another really important aspect of it is the fight or flight response, where we, our ancestors, in order to survive, they needed to be very tribal, and they needed to jump at 100 shadows in order to get away from the saber-toothed tigers. You could have heard of that as a saber-toothed tiger response, or to fight, that's the flight response, or to fight an attacking tribal member. So that was a very instantaneous, quick decision-making system. So right now, those two patterns and other related ones, a number of cognitive, what are called cognitive biases, dangerous judgment errors that come from how our brain is wired, they cause us to make a lot of bad decisions based on using our intuitions, our gut reactions. And we can change those gut reactions to have more healthy mental habits, which is what I talk about in the book. You know, naturally and intuitively, we all would eat with our hands as babies do, and as we ate in the savanna environment. We've learned how to eat with a fork and knife. Not an intuitive, not a natural behavior, but we've learned how to do it. You know, we've learned how to drive a car, not a natural or not an intuitive behavior. Now we've learned to do it, we can do it on autopilot, just like we can eat with our fork and knife on autopilot. So the goal of the book, what I'm talking about here, is how do we go from this primitive, natural, savage self to this more civilized self? And we have done it in some areas. Many of us can restrain ourselves from taking that third chocolate chip cookie. It's a difficult thing, which is why we have the obesity epidemic here in the United States. We can restrain ourselves from sitting on the couch and watching Netflix all day, which is the natural, comfortable, intuitive thing. We can go and, do exercises because we know it's good for our health. But we don't know what's good for our mental health, for our mental fitness. Right now, we don't have good advice on how do we make good decisions, how do we become mentally fit, because the advice that people give is the advice of, go and sit on your couch and watch Netflix all day, or, eat a dozen box of donuts and dozen box of whatever chocolate chip cookies, which is go with your gut, do what's comfortable, be primal, be savage. It's terrible advice. Leads to a lot of dangerous judgment errors that really hurt people, just like it hurt my parents and it hurt those business leaders earlier that I mentioned. So that's why we should not simply go with our gut, and we should retrain our gut into our gut reactions, our intuitions, to have the more mentally fit mental habits.
You gave me hope, and now I have a sigh of relief because you said that that key phrase that we have to retrain our gut. Because
Yes.
when I saw the name of the book and I started to read it, in my head, never follow your gut, because it helped me. Following my gut helped me many times in my life, and now you are confirming, yes, it's okay to follow your gut, but you have to retrain your mental habits of making decisions. This
That's
is
right.
wonderful. Thank you for this clarification.
Yeah, you're welcome. And it's about retraining our natural intuitions. Just like I said, we have a natural intuition to eat as much sugar as possible, and that's all from the savanna environment. Many of us who have success, I mean, some of us it's difficult, but many of us have succeeded in retraining ourselves to not eat as much sugar as possible. But that requires deliberate retraining. So when I say never follow your gut, you should not follow your natural primal savanna intuitions. And you should retrain yourself to have healthy mental habits, just like you learned how to drive a car. Now you can do it on autopilot, but it took a long time to learn how to drive a car.
Exactly. So you also touched a very interesting topic or idea of, or you gave an example. We are having this mass media information telling us sit on a couch and watch Netflix and eat bunch of donuts. But also, as an immigrant myself, when I talk to people, I always say this: yes, America offered McDonald's and Coca-Cola to the world, which is not the healthiest, which are not the healthiest things. But also, America has a bunch of fitness opportunities, and America has Whole Foods and farmers markets. How about this? And don't you think that I hope you will agree, it's about the choices we make, but
Yes, it
to
is it is very much about the choices we make. There's a reason that McDonald's is more profitable than farmers markets.
what is the reason?
The reason is that it's much easier to appeal to our basic primal natural intuitive emotions. This is why the people who tell you go with your gut, follow your intuitions, be primal, people like Tony Robbins and so on, they make the money because they tell you to do what you're comfortable with. They don't tell you to get outside of your comfort zone. They don't tell you to grow. They don't tell you to put on your sweats and go to the gym. They don't tell you to restrain yourself from eating that third chocolate chip cookie. They tell you, eat all the chocolate chip cookies you want and sit on the couch and watch Netflix. They tell you this is how you should live your life, doing what's comfortable for you, doing what comes naturally, doing the tribal primal thing, having that fight or flight response. That is the advice. And so the people who give you this advice, they tend to be paid a lot of money because they tell you to do what you're comfortable with. Now, we've learned in some areas that this is a bad idea. Now, if you think back to medicine 100 years ago, doctors sold snake oil, that's kind of the common phrase that's used, with a mixture of cocaine, alcohol, and sugar. And that's what they told you. This is where the name Coca-Cola actually comes from. It used to have cocaine. So that is something that people sold because it caused you to feel good. Now we know from 100 years of medical research that that's a bad idea. You would hopefully fire your doctor if he told you to drink snake oil with cocaine, medicine, and alcohol as a way to treat yourself. And right now we're getting the same information about decision making. Decision making, telling you to follow your gut, is the same sort of snake oil advice of drinking cocaine, alcohol, and whatever, eating a dozen box of donuts, same thing. And unfortunately, the people who tell you this, McDonald's gives you the snake oil. It gives you what's very comfortable and it gives you what feels good. And a lot of people eat that because it may cause them to feel good and it's comfortable and convenient. They don't make the more difficult, healthy choice of eating, of going to Whole Foods or going to the farmer's market, eating more healthy foods. And they don't, even though it's going to be much better for them in the long run, much better for their health, they're going to live longer, they're going to have much better physical health. But many people have already learned that they do need to do this, and they do make the better choices of going to farmers markets, like you said. And now my goal is to convey the same thing in decision making. In decision making, you need to make the farmers market choice of using healthy mental habits and retraining, not going with your primal, savage, or intuitive self. That is critical to make this success. I mean, I talk about, giving an example of an accent. He talked about kind of talking with an accent. So a really interesting example of one of these cognitive biases is one of these aspects of cognitive biases is called accent discrimination, where Americans, mainstream Americans, trust people with accents like you and I less than they trust people who don't have an accent. And that they don't even realize they're doing it. It's just a natural, intuitive thing for them. It's called accent discrimination. And you could see extensive research showing that people with foreign accents are trusted less, regardless of the accuracy of what they're saying. This is one of those things that we need to retrain, and we need to get Americans, we ourselves, and we need to get others to retrain ourselves to not distrust people with foreign accents less. But learning this about this concept, you need to learn about it, and you need to train your mental habits to see that, oh, this person has an accent, therefore I'm likely to trust that person less. And therefore I need to compensate for my lack of trust to trust them more than I would otherwise. And the same thing applies to any aspect of tribalism. So, and that's just one out of many, many dangerous judgment errors that we all experience. And so this is why I talk about needing to retrain yourself from not doing the comfortable, intuitive, natural, savage thing, to retrain yourself to make better decisions.
Interesting. Knowing this, and I remember that's how you started your speech. You said that you mentioned your accent, and you said the same thing about trust. And
Yes.
knowing this, every time when you speak in front of people, the audience, does it give you anxiety that you know this, that you're not going to be trusted 100% because of your accent, but you go there anyway, and you talk in front of those people, and you train, educate those people. Do you have anxiety?
I actually, you by now, I mean, I can't drop my accent by now. I am too old for that. So, like you said at the beginning of the speech, when I give speeches, I often start it with putting my accent out front and saying, hey, here's what my accent is coming from, and here's something that you might not be realizing that you're being discriminating about. And that is a prejudice that you have. This is one of the cognitive biases that I talk about. So I use my accent, I use myself as a case study to illustrate the kind of problems that result from cognitive biases. And of course, then I talk about other topics. But then they can make this personal connection to me. They can say, this person, I look like a white, tall, male guy. I don't look like I'm not from around here. I don't look, so when I come on stage, they see me, there's that white male privilege that I have going for me. But when they have that accent, when they hear the accent, that's when there's a discrimination starts coming up. And so when I bring that out front and center and I say, hey, this is what's happening here, let's talk about it, then that helps people in the audience see what I'm actually referring to front and center.
Interesting. That brings me back to what I started to do when I came to this country. I felt different because of many reasons, and one of them was my accent. And I was shy. I was very shy in the beginning, and I sort of didn't think too much of myself because of that. But you know, when I started to do public speeches, I started to use this as a marketing tool for myself. With the difference between you and me, I didn't do it maybe in the beginning of my speech. Maybe I remember first time it came up somewhere in the middle, and I made it as a joke. I said, probably you can tell by my accent that I am from Russia and I am from Siberia. And I did it several times, and I saw that people got interested, and even more in one of the face-to-face conversations at one of the conferences. One person asked me if I'm real, and if he can touch me, because I was from Siberia, and probably for that person, meeting the person from Siberia for the first time was so shocking that he probably read in the books about Siberia and thought that it's a prison and there is nothing, but it is a 2 million city, Omsk, I'm coming from. And yeah, I will never forget that question. Can I touch you? Are you
Wow,
real?
yeah,
And
that's special.
it is special. That moment, I realized, hey, this is your marketing tool, and that's what makes you special. And that how it rewired my brain and boosted my confidence. Going from not being confident about my accent and being from Russia and from Siberia to totally different extreme of this helped me a lot. But it was a transition. I had to make an effort. I had to overcome that fear, and I had to experiment with that. And it takes a lot. And
Yeah, and that's a good example of tribalism. It's you understand that you're not coming from these people's tribe. So the natural reaction, the gut reaction within us when we're going to someone and they're not part of our tribe, when we're speaking to someone from not from our tribe, is to experience fear, experience anxiety because we're afraid of rejection. And our autopilot system is preparing us for rejection, and it's preparing us to flee from an attacking tribal member or something like that. So we have to develop healthy mental habits, and you've developed one as you're describing yourself. You have to reframe your thinking. And that is what I'm talking about in the book. How do you reframe your thinking into healthy mental habits to make better decisions about how to approach these difficult issues? You have to change your intuitive approach to these things because our intuitive approach to the modern world, we're just not adapted for it. Our gut reactions are not adapted for the modern world, and that is why we need to change them. And that's what my book is about. How do we change our intuitions to make actually effective decisions that serve us well in the modern world and allow us to succeed?
totally agree with that. And also, when I was reading the book, I came across the word that I fell in love, which is debiasing. We all have biases, but you are talking about debiasing.
That's right.
And I think you will agree with me that coming from different backgrounds, different cultures, we bring our biases from our cultures. And of course, you were so little, you brought just a little bit. But me, working with immigration population a lot and preparing them for their citizenship interviews, I see this a lot. And sometimes it's hard to debias them, if I can borrow your word.
Sure.
While preparing them for the interview, simple example. Eye contact. I always emphasize that American culture likes eye contact. And especially in Asian cultures, it might be a problem. And sometimes people struggle with certain things, and it takes time if they see the value in certain things, right, in this society. So what would be your sort of advice? Yeah, I think the right word to say advice. When people come to this country with their cultural biases, how can they integrate into the society and take the opportunities of the society and build a successful life that they are coming for to this country?
The most important thing is to understand the broader framework and principles going on. If you just teach someone to have eye contact, that's helpful, but it will not transfer to many other things you need to teach them. So it's that, and that's challenging. Now, if you teach them that you're coming to the society, and this society has a lot of different norms than your society, which you're used to, and you have, you're bringing a lot of your biases with you. So what you need to do, who came to this country as an immigrant, is to understand that your goal, if you want to fit in, is to change your framework of thinking and feeling, retrain your autopilot system. So right now in the American autopilot system, it's very appropriate to smile when you see someone. In a lot of cultures, it's quite inappropriate to smile when you see someone.
So true.
And that's just that's just one example of where this is one of so many things that you need to retrain. If you just retrain one thing at a time, you will never actually fit in. It will take you so much time unless you come as a small kid and learn all of these things, and your brain is already pretty flexible and you don't have many ingrained biases. But if you come and say, hey, I know that I'm bringing a lot of the mental framework with me that's going to be harmful for me in my new society. So I need to deliberately learn and see what I need to change, how I need to shift myself to fit in. And it's not that this new society's framework is good or bad, it's just different. So not having a judgmental approach to this is good, is helpful. And once you have that framework of, hey, I need to learn these things, then each instance that you learn about makes the next one easier. If you learn how to smile at people, you will have the mental motion and your as part of your mental habit of relearning a specific way of being in your society, a norm and etiquette. And then the next one becomes quite a bit easier because you're looking for them and you're looking for opportunities to practice. You're not seeing it as an annoying, frustrating thing that Americans are doing badly and you need to somehow do this bad thing. So you're not judging it negatively. You're looking for an opportunity to improve. So this is all about a mental framework. You know, the reason I'm sharing this mental framework of the autopilot system and the intentional system is it's both accurate according to the research. And if you develop this mental framework, if you see the world through this mental framework saying, hey, I have a number of mostly autopilot system responses that are going to be harmful for me in the modern world. So let me look at where my autopilot system responses are going to be harmful for me and see how I can retrain them to be more effective for this modern world, which is different from the savannah environment. That's going to be a very helpful mental framework. And the book, Never Go With Your Gut, How Pioneering Leaders Make the Best Decisions and Avoid Business Disasters, talks about that specifically as how it applies to your professional world. And my next book, The Blind Spots Between Us, which will be released in April 2020, talks about that, how it applies to our personal relationships, because you know there is a reason there is a 40% divorce rate in this country, and it's not a good situation. So we make many judgment errors, and we need to have this broader mental framework of understanding that we have many judgment errors when we come to this country, when you as an immigrant come to this country, and that you need to retrain yourself to fit in well in this country.
When you are talking about this, I feel you're talking about the next level. When a person realizes, yes, I have a problem, I have to retrain my thinking or take care of my mental health. So coming making one step back. So here's that new immigrant from Iran, right, starting his life in this country, what would be, how can he see the opportunities? How, what is the path, or what can be exercise or advice or your personal experience? How can this guy from Iran come to the conclusion or to the idea, here we go, I need to do something about my mental health? Because the reason I'm asking, I see that communities, Bulgarian communities, Polish communities, Russian communities, they live in their communities. They don't go to America, like one of my students told me, Anna, we don't go to America. We don't need to speak English. We have Russian, we have Russian stores, whatever we need. So, and that is the problem. So the question, how can that immigrant see and open up to the opportunities and expand his thinking and make the first step?
Well, what really helps with that, first of all, is to, so the framework that I'm talking about is what you need, is the framework that you need to develop in order to succeed. Now, before that, the first thing to understand is what are the person's emotions, because we are all, what the research on the emotions and decision-making shows is that our emotions motivate about 80 to 90% of our decisions. So just as a baseline, that's how things work. Our emotions are overwhelmingly critical for motivating our decisions. So you need to understand, where is this person coming from? What are their feelings? When the student tells you that, you know, Anna, I have stores and so on, I don't need any, I totally understand what you're talking about, coming from the Russian community. It often comes from a combination of fear, fear of the unknown, fear of the different, fear of not being in your tribe, and comfort, desire for what you're comfortable with, what you like, and so on. So those are the underlying emotions that people come with. Now, there's a very specific cognitive bias, which is one of the many, there's over 100 cognitive biases, which are the dangerous judgment errors that our brain makes because of how it's wired. You can look them up on Wikipedia. There's a list of cognitive biases, over 100 of them. And my book talks about the 30 most dangerous ones for professional settings and how you address them. And the cognitive bias here is called hyperbolic discounting. The hyperbolic discounting is where we overvalue short-term, especially emotional rewards, of for the sake over larger long-term gains, emotional and so on. So the person who's coming here tells you, you know, we have our stores, they don't see the long-term benefits of learning all of these topics and having many more options and having many more opportunities for success, because just staying within your community, within the community of immigrants, is very limiting within this country, and it greatly diminishes your opportunities for social mobility, for growth, for success in the long term. And so people sacrifice the long term for the short term, not realizing that they're doing it. So one is to, first of all, understand where the person is coming from emotionally. And I gave some examples. And that's something that you need to understand, whatever it is for each individual person. And then see what their goals are. You know, where do they want to be? You know, how, let's say this person is 30 years old. Where do they want to be when they're 50? Do they still want to be living in this community? Do they still want to be, I mean, and if they want to be living in this community, you know, that maybe that's okay. But if they actually want to succeed and be a successful person in the United States and make some kind of a positive impact on society for themselves, for their children, you know, where do they want their children to be in, you know, 40 years? And if they stay within their community, their children are much less likely to succeed, of course. So thinking about helping them see the long-term consequences of their decision-making based on their own goals, you know, not saying, hey, you know, if you stay here in this community for 20 years, you will not be successful. Ask them, be curious, where do you see yourself in 20 years? Where do you see your kids in 40 years? Where, what do you want to see happen? And then walk back from that long-term vision. Now, maybe that person wants to be making, you know, a good salary, $100,000, you know, in 10 years from now, 20 years from now, for example, if they're financially motivated, which many people are, or whatever they are, they want their kids to be somehow successful, you know, graduate from Ivy League, and then walk back from that. You know, what does it take for that to happen? And you can show them that this is what it will take. This is what they need to do in order for that long-term vision to occur.
Interesting. And I think that I can add or maybe highlight once again on what you mentioned, having long-term goals and overcoming the fear, because it's one thing
yes.
to have a goal, but do you do anything with this goal, right? The fear of stepping into something you don't know, and the fear of not being confident with the language, with the immigration population, that's the biggest psychological barrier that I work with. And it's huge. But since it's done, you can see that smile on the face, you see confidence, it changes the entire world.
Oh, yeah.
I agree with that. When we started talking with you, and I started to read the book, you made the parallel with sports, with fitness. How is fitness related to the decision making that you are talking in your book?
So I mentioned before about the physical fitness. When we've learned right now how being physically fit, so doctors have shown based on extensive research that snake oil is not good for you, that you know, cocaine, alcohol, and sugar mixture is not a good thing for you. And that has taken, you know, over 100 years of research right now, and we're pretty confident in that. So right now we know that if a doctor tells us to, you know, drink some snake oil with cocaine, alcohol, and sugar, we probably shouldn't listen to that doctor. If a doctor tells us to eat a dozen donuts and sit on the couch and watch Netflix all day, that's not a good doctor. They might be telling us something that we like to hear, that is comfortable for us, but that's not a good doctor. In the same way, that will harm your physical fitness, both your ability to be physically fit, have strong muscles, and your weight, your physical well-being, and so on. So we know that about physical fitness. Now we need to do the same thing for mental fitness. Engaging with effective decision-making strategies, the ones I describe in my book, how to learn how to make good decisions, is the same thing. You need to be, your brain is your most important muscle in this world, in this disrupted, increasingly changing world. Your brain is unquestionably your most important muscle. But how many of us take the time to make sure that we are mentally fit, not simply physically fit, not simply watching our diet and physical exercise, but also doing mental exercises? So the mental exercises, and this is the decision-making exercises that I'm talking about. This is how do you retrain? And you retrain these things, you know, you don't do it once. It's like you don't go to the gym once a day, once and say, I'm done. This is a constant effort because you need to constantly keep up your brain in a state where you can effectively succeed. And so that's what the mental fitness is about, training your brain to address the dangerous judgment errors that we all have just as part of how we're wired. You know, just as we have a temptation to eat as much sugar as possible and to watch Netflix all day, you need to retrain your brain and keep it trained to be mentally fit. Keep yourself remembering and exercising to address all of these dangerous judgment errors over time. Being aware of them, and that takes, of course, learning about them and then taking specific steps to address each one. And there's more general techniques that I describe in the book that you can apply to both simple daily decisions and more complex decisions that you can use to address all of these dangerous judgment errors. But you need to keep doing it over time to keep up your mental fitness. Otherwise, it's the same thing as going to the gym once and not doing anything afterward.
That's so true. And my heart is pumping when we talk about this, especially fast, because I think of myself as the perfect example of how fitness changed my life. First on the physical level, of course, like everybody, I started to go to the gym and do some exercises without really understanding what I was doing. And then when you do it long enough and it becomes your habit, then that's when you start seeing the results.
Yes.
And then I started to see the results in my life, the results in thinking and as we know, chemistry is changing overall in your body. And I started to love the feeling. I started to love the level of energy that I have every day. And overall, it's just wonderful. It's great. And the other layer is, like you are saying, building different habits of making different decisions. And when it clicks together, your fitness life, your mental health, that's when a person really starts seeing the results. I agree with you. And I can't emphasize enough how important it is to eat healthy, to work out, and you don't have to do a lot. Just a 20-minute walk is enough. And retraining your brain, making different decisions. That's wonderful. Excellent. So living in this country long enough, do you have any American dream?
I think my American dream is to address the problems that I see in this country, the suffering that I see in this country. I've come to this country and I've seen so many people suffer because they're making bad decisions. And my dream has developed over time, you know, since I was a kid, to make a serious impact on addressing the bad decision making that I see in this country. And it's in all areas of life, business, relationships, politics. Let's not even go into there. There's so many bad decisions made. And what I would like to see as my legacy of the accomplishment of my American dream would be to know that I've made a good positive impact on the way that people make decisions in this country. You know, we've talked and you've read the book and now I know that I made a positive impact on you and that's wonderful. And you can convey this information to people who listen to your podcast and of course to your clients who will help teach how to make better decisions. And that's wonderful. And that's why I like talking to coaches, people who help others. And that's why I like working with leaders, people who impact others. So knowing that I've made a positive impact, a serious, significant positive impact on people's lives is really in making better decisions and avoiding suffering. That's my American dream.
Excellent, wonderful. And I wouldn't limit yourself just within this country. I would say maybe we will see your books being translated into different languages. And I would love to see a Russian as the first
Me
one.
Me too. Me too.
And believe me, talking to people from different backgrounds and cultures, I can say that they can use some help. They can use some guidance, I should say, because we cannot make people making right decisions. And what is the right decision? I have my own right decision. You have yours, right?
Yeah, the only thing that we know is the right is about the process. How do you make the decision? The outcome is individual to each one because we all have different values. We know what the right process for decision-making is. So that is the difference. Can't tell anyone what the right decision is for them. I can tell them how to make the decision.
This is wonderful. This is very valuable, what you just said. I love it. And I really enjoyed our interview. And I'm very thankful that you agreed to this and you shared your expertise and knowledge and the scientific background of your approach. And this book is wonderful. I really like the exercises and the questionnaire. I think it has 30 questions that you offer to the leaders, to the managers of the companies that they can use. It's been wonderful. And thank you very much once again, Gleb, for this wonderful interview. And I hope that we will stay in touch. Mm-hmm. And who knows, maybe we'll come up with another interview.
Sure. It's been a pleasure, Anna, and thank you very much. And for people who want, I have a free version of the questionnaire on the dangerous judgment errors in the workplace on disaster avoidance experts/subscribe. Again, disaster avoidance experts/subscribe. There's a free version of the questionnaire that Anna mentioned for the 30 most dangerous judgment errors in professional settings. Useful for anyone who cares about their professional future.
Wonderful, excellent. And by the way, where people can find you?
They can find me, as I mentioned, the book. They can find any physical bookstore or online bookstore. It's published by a good traditional publisher called Career Press. So again, the book is called Never Go With Your Gut, How Pioneering Leaders Make the Best Decisions and Avoid Business Disasters. They can find me on disaster avoidance experts.com. Again, disaster avoidance experts.com, a lot of free resources, a newsletter, blogs, videos, and of course, consulting, coaching, training, speaking if you're interested in that. As I mentioned before, the free questionnaire is on disasteravoidanceexperts.com/subscribe. Again, disasteravoidanceexperts.com/subscribe, and I'm pretty active on LinkedIn, so you can connect with me there. Gleb Tsipursky, GlebTsipursky.
Wonderful, excellent. And I can add regarding the website that the videos are very helpful to watch and to listen to you as a speaker and get the idea what kind of message you bring to the people.
Excellent.
Well, thank you very much once again. I hope you enjoy the rest of your weekend and have a happy new year.
Thank you. Have a happy new year as well. And of course, for our cultural background, it's the most important holiday of the
It did. Yes, I agree with that.